Hello, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Traquel Art Supplies. Traquel offers sensibly priced art supplies conveniently shipped right to your door. For over 30 years, Traquel has been obsessed with the art of brush making. They've been testing and tweaking their brushes to get the perfect balance, flow, and snap. Go to traquel.com and use promo code SAVVY16 to get 15% off your next order. Parker Stremmel is my guest today. Parker is the gallery manager at Stremmel Gallery in Reno, Nevada. The gallery opened in 1969 with an outdoor and wildlife emphasis, but by 2003, it evolved to reflect a more modern focus. Today, Stremmel Gallery specializes in contemporary paintings, drawings, and sculptures by mid-career and established American and European artists. In this episode, Parker and I talk about why galleries have limits with the number of artists they work with, the benefits of standing by artists as they experiment and grow, and how Stremmel talks to collectors. We also talk about the cornerstone of a healthy artist-gallery relationship, honesty, communication, and why Stremmel Gallery employs some counterintuitive tactics to help their artists grow and succeed. Also, Parker tells the harrowing story of when a visitor slammed his fist into a piece of art. Luckily, the piece was undamaged, but wow. Now that it's over, it's kind of funny, but I would never have been able to stay as composed as Parker did when it happened. So without further ado, here is Parker Stremmel. Parker, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Well, I've enjoyed your podcast. I actually listened to the Billy O'Donnell one this morning. That was really insightful. I really liked his, I liked what he had to say. It was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I try to keep it really, you know, get a lot of voices in there because obviously there's a lot of voices in the art world. And the more we can hear from everybody, I think the better off everyone is.
Agreed. I mean, the art world's one of the paramount things in the art world is exposure.
Yeah, and balancing that or coming to terms with that, I think, is always so hard for people, especially artists, because they don't want to feel like they're selling out, but you need to promote mm-hmm. yourself. And like, it's this thing that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with.
Absolutely. That's why I think galleries, and I know this is somewhat self-serving, but that's the importance of galleries, is that to that degree, galleries can really take that off of the artist's plate and allow the artist to simply create. And the gallery can focus on the marketing and the clients and the displaying, and artists can simply just focus on doing what they do best.
Yeah, that's the dream.
Yeah, exactly. But now it's becoming more and more difficult in this day and age. But then again, so is everything.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about, we're just going to dive right into this. How about that?
Fine. But hey, that works great for me.
Because I'm sure you're, I know you're on a schedule. Or if you're not, that if you get some extra time, like sleep would be good right now.
No chance on that one. The dogs won't let that happen. So at this point, it's just power through for the next 18 years.
Oh, can you tell me a little bit about Stremmel Gallery and sort of the genesis of it and how it's evolved over the last, because it's been 30 years, right?
It's been actually 47 years.
Oh my
we
gosh.
Started in 1969. There's a little discrepancy as to who actually did it, but I'm pretty certain it was my grandfather and my uncle. There's where the discrepancy exists is if my grandfather just was, if it was his idea or, but that's for the old people to discuss. And that was well before I was even born. So it started in 1969 and it was more kind of an outdoor wildlife type gallery. I mean, in Reno, Nevada, it's not necessarily known for being a modern and contemporary gallery. And back then, and even still now, we have quite a large outdoor population. And then it tended to evolve. A lot of landscape artists. We had Manuel Neary for a while. So probably in the 80s, I'd say it really transitioned into more of a modern and contemporary feel. And then in 2003 is when really there was that shift, because we remodeled the building and we changed the exterior and the interior. And we really put our focus on being a modern and contemporary gallery, primarily West Coast artists. But we do have some international artists, and we do have some on the East Coast, like Wolf Kahn, who's pretty well known, who's out of New York. So kind of that's where our focus has been for the last 13 years.
And what prompted that shift?
You know, I think it was really just a lifestyle switch, because my uncle Pete is the patriarch of the gallery, and his wife Turkey, which is her real name, really have spearheaded this thing for the last 35, 40 years. And I think that was just where they wanted to take it. They've always been a huge, huge fan of modern and contemporary art. Their collection is primarily modern and contemporary. And I think they just wanted to make that switch fully. It also coincided with the Nevada Museum of Art going through its upgrades and remodeling. And we actually had our remodel finished a week before the museums did. So it was really kind of almost a synergistic thing in the Northern Nevada / Northern California area. Now, we are technically Northern Nevada, but we do cater to a lot of Northern California as well, because we're only 3 hours away from San Francisco, an hour and a half away from Sacramento. So we do have major metropolis populations close by.
Yeah, I would imagine. And you get so many people probably, especially from San Francisco, who go to Tahoe, and then it's just a quick drive.
Absolutely. And now Truckee, which is only 30 minutes away from Reno, which is in California, is becoming kind of a hot spot for a lot of tech people, a lot of LA people. So we're only 30 minutes away from that on the weekends. And it's been nice. We're kind of in our own little bubble in that sense, that we're able to reach that broad of a market.
Very cool. I'm curious, you know, because we were talking a little bit about the promotional aspect of art. We touched on that slightly, but I would love it if you could elaborate a little bit on that. Like, how do you see these changes now that artists have sort of a direct line to collectors almost because of social media, and they're able to promote themselves in ways that were impossible just, you know, 10 years ago?
That's a fabulous question. And I'll tell you a quick story. So on Thursday, we had our opening for Phyllis Schaefer. We're her only gallery. And what Phyllis does, just by backstory, is she's a landscape artist, but she has more of a whimsical, psychedelic effect to her paintings, to her gouaches and to her oils. And she's really, really popular in this area. We've had to create a waiting list for her. So yesterday she came into the gallery and we were chatting in the morning, and I had mentioned something to her, because with this list, we don't reveal the images until basically the launch. And we have to go through our waiting list. We give our clients a chance to see the images first before releasing them out to the general public. And so how this relates is, I said to Phyllis yesterday morning, it was kind of interesting this go around, because we didn't have this problem 3 years ago with her last show. People would call me up and they would say, hey, I really like this piece. And I would be caught off guard, because I would be thinking, how in the world did they know we even had this piece? We haven't photographed it. We haven't published it. We haven't publicized it. We haven't mentioned it to anyone. And it dawned on me that Phyllis was using Facebook to promote her work, which is fabulous. But that's now how it's kind of shifting, that you really do have to work with the artist on that, especially if there is a demand for the work. And so on one front, it can help, because it can bring awareness to the gallery and any upcoming exhibitions. But on another, in a weird sense, and we don't have this problem, but I've heard from other galleries who have this problem, they end up competing with their artists, because the individual can just reach out to the artist directly. Now, our artists are fabulous and they will send everybody to us. But there are instances in bigger galleries and in bigger markets where a person can go straight to the artist and cut out the gallery. So it hasn't been truly defined yet. Luckily, we have such a great relationship with all of our artists, and knock on wood, we've been able to avoid it. But it is tricky going forward, because nobody fully has a grasp on it. You have individuals who are comfortable buying works online without ever having seen them in person. You have those who maybe know the artist and are familiar with the work, and so they're comfortable in that regard. But then you have others, and it tends to be lumped with millennials, but I think it extends beyond that. I think it extends to anybody who has a computer and really how they're kind of brought up looking at things. People are totally fine buying work online, having never seen it in person. So the marketing aspect, especially with the proliferation of social media, has become a little tricky. It's almost like the Wild West to a degree. And I'm sure once everybody really figures it out, it'll completely change.
Yeah. Yeah, the technology will change. But I think it sort of it shifts the relationship a little bit. And it And it calls for very clear communication, I would think, between the gallery and the artist. I mean, you're saying that so far, luckily, you haven't had any issues with this, but I'm curious what's coming up. And I don't know the answer to this, but I'm just thinking about, you know, it used to be that artists had sort of exclusivity contracts with different galleries, meaning that, for example, if somebody had an exclusivity contract with you guys, then perhaps they could, it would be something, you know, I have no idea, but I'm just saying, like, it would be something like you can't sell your artwork in this geographical zone, or depending on the agreement, it could be very broad or very narrow. But now with the internet, that sort of changes everything. And when artists are building up their own, or, you know, have the capability of building up their own audience, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know how that works, because it seems like it used to be that you would just rely on the gallery and their list and their clients, and that was that.
And that's a great point that you bring up. And I think to a degree still, that's where a gallery comes in huge, because we see who comes in, we know who calls, we see the emails, we have conversations with people, and we kind of establish both a mental and in some instances a physical database. Whereas the artist might only have a certain a myopic portion of that. And that's why we really feel that the relationship with the artist is so, so important, because there is a level of trust. That a lot of times artists will give their work to a gallery, excuse me, will put their work on consignment with a gallery, and maybe they don't hear from that gallery for years. We've seen instances worldwide where galleries have been months, if not years, behind on paying certain artists, and then it gets into the court system, and that dirty laundry is aired everywhere.
Right.
We avoid that. We try to avoid that, because that relationship is so, so important. Without the artists, we don't have any work. We don't have anything to put on the walls. I like to joke that we just have the walls, and it's the artists who do the hard work, because everything looks great on a white wall, and everything changes on a white wall. And so I think we're lucky. Our artists understand that and realize that. But in some instances where it's just almost purely a financial transaction, I think you do lose that personal touch. And again, we value that personal touch so, so much. A number of our artists have become more than just our artists. They've become our dear friends. They've come to weddings. They've gone to big events. They're important parts of our lives. And we couldn't think of doing business without that aspect. But that's not the case everywhere else. And I don't mean to sound Pollyanna on our end. I think it's just we've been lucky, because we're kind of old school in that regard, and we've been able to maintain that.
Well, obviously you guys are doing something right, because you've been in business for 47 years, and it looks like there's like, you know, from what I can tell, you guys are doing great. And just to give a really, really quick backstory, sorry, because we jumped right into this interview, I just want to mention that I met Parker when I was coming. I fly, if I leave anywhere and I need to fly, I fly out of Reno. And so I stopped by his gallery, the Stremel Gallery, on a suggestion from one of the listeners, Denise Klitzy. So thank you, Denise. This has been, I've had a lot of fun talking to Parker, both when I stopped by and I took like 2 hours of your time, and now.
It was I think that was a Friday morning. That was a fabulous morning, because I got to get up and talk about our artists and look at our artwork. And so that was a nice bonus for me. So thank you.
No, it was great. I'll jump into that later. But yeah, Parker took me into the back room and I got to see all the art in the back. And we talked a long time about all the artists and all this fun stuff. But going back to what we were just talking about, I'm curious, to me, it just looks like you have very, very strong relationships with your artists. What are some of the things that you see as really crucial to developing a strong relationship between an artist and a gallery?
Well, first off, and it sounds incredibly obvious, but it's vital, honesty, just being direct and upfront with the artist, but also realizing that we're on a journey together. We can't sell work that isn't good, and they can't bring in work that isn't good. And so we kind of work hand in hand with them. We take feedback from our clients, but also really giving the artist the latitude to develop and to pursue things they really want and what they feel is important. Again, if the work isn't good, people are going to realize that. They might not know how to talk about it. They might not know how to write about it, but they know how to think about it and they know how to feel about it. And I think that's pretty obvious. And so we really, really value that upfront and honest relationship with our artists, but also getting an idea where they want to go and how they want to pursue their careers, because exposure is so, so important. This last show, and I only refer to it because it's topical, with Phyllis Schaefer, because we have that list, everything was sold prior. And a number of our clients asked, well, why can't I just take the work now? The exhibition runs through December 10th. And I said, well, if you take your work, we don't have a show and people can't see this work, because there are, I think, 36 works in the show, which mathematically is about 36 people who bought a work. But mm-hmm. there are going to be dozens and hopefully hundreds, if maybe not thousands, but most likely just hundreds more eyeballs looking at this work. And that exposure is important for Phyllis and each artist, because work needs to be seen. Because once somebody buys it, they might have the occasional museum show that calls, but by and large, it's on someone's walls and no one will see it, or at least relative to a gallery. So exposure is key. And I think when you came in before, we talked about the importance of Phyllis. In this case, we actually used Phyllis expanding her reach, because work yes. needs to be seen. We have another artist, a guy named Leonard Kosianski, who's producing these great works, but they take a while. And so it's difficult to have a body for a show. And yes, we're in the on the commercial side of things, where we want to sell work, but we also want that work to be seen. It needs to be appreciated, because that helps the artist both short term and long term, because people get a comprehension about the artist, understanding each artist's body of work. And so again, exposure, exposure, exposure. We can't say it enough. It's so, so vital.
When I visited your gallery, you said something that really surprised me. You mentioned that you wanted to help one of your artists get more exposure by helping them get into another gallery. That seemed really counterintuitive to me. Why would you do that when it seems like it's helping your competitors?
Because we really, really, and I understand why people think it's a counterintuitive point, because it is. You have something that sells, you want to hoard it, you want to hold on to it. But again, it's so important for other people to see this work. Phyllis's work is primarily based on the Sierra Nevada mountain ranges. This last show, she did some work focusing on Carmel, the Point Lobos area. And then even Wyoming, she had an artist residency, UCross, in Sheridan, Wyoming. So she did some works there. But by and large, she was a Tahoe painter, a Sierra Nevada painter. And so that's not going to resonate with somebody in the South. Well, we had a show for her probably about 5-6 years ago where she painted the Sonora Desert. So that resonated with people in Arizona and also up here, because we are a desert climate. But it's part of this is promoting the artist's work. I mentioned Leonard Kosianski, because the work he's creating is great, but he can only do so many so quickly because it takes a long time. And that's not doing the artist any good if only a select amount of people are seeing it. Also, we tend to believe in a rising tide lifts all ship. Look, people are going to come in to see Phyllis's show, but they're also going to see our other artists there. They're also going to see what we have on display in the back and potentially what we have coming up. And so it kind of helps everyone out. And it's not just about churning and burning. We really do value that relationship with the artist. And Turkey Strummel was the one who really got Phyllis going. She found Phyllis probably about 15 years ago and really helped guide her career to the point where it is. And I think there's a certain loyalty that we each feel, that we at the gallery feel to our artists, and hopefully vice versa. So it's not a proprietary thing. Look, the art world is, there's a ton of art out there. There are a ton of artists out there. I think it's okay to have the approach that, hey, let's help each other out, because what's good for you can be good for us.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just that, like you said, people tend to want to hoard things or not share things. And I mean, and that's kind of what this podcast actually is all about. You know, our collective intelligence is so much stronger than any individual. Like this podcast, you know, I'm the host of it, I do it, but I've learned so much from talking to everybody about it. It's incredible. And that would never happen if I didn't share it.
And you need to see art to understand it. And I know that sounds somewhat redundant, but it's true. And this is a problem that's what's fascinating, touching on an earlier subject, that of social media and online and how people are viewing art. You still need to see it in person because there is something about that connection, that physical connection that you just don't get on a flat screen. Even if you're looking at a photograph, I'm looking at a Richard Mizrach photograph right now from his Bay Area series, from his Golden Gate Bridge series. And it's just a different feel looking at it in person than online or in a flyer or in an e-blast or in any other way that's just a flat presentation. It's so important to see art and to experience art and to be around art. And the more you see, the better understanding you have. Even if you don't like it, it's inciting some kind of feeling that but as a proxy enhances what you do like. Maybe you don't realize it at that moment, but when you see something you do like, you're able to kind of counter that against what you don't like, and it strengthens that feeling. And that's something that you just can't get without seeing art in person.
I agree. I was really, I think, you know, to kind of back that up, I would say when I saw Phyllis's work, I could not believe, like, I was just so fascinated with it because especially as an artist, looking at what she does and looking at the way that she handles gouache, it is like her execution is perfect. It's so amazing. And as an artist, I'm looking at that going like, well, you know, I paint in gouache and I can't do that. There's no way I can do that without another 5 or 10 years of practicing exclusively in gouache. But I would never have noticed that or gotten that if I had seen it online. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, and it's a fabulous point that you bring up. And just to give Phyllis a little more props, with the gouache, she's at another disadvantage in that a lot of her paintings are at elevation. And I'm talking significant elevation, like 7,000, 8,000 feet, and it'll dry out faster. So she really has to be accurate with it because gouache is like a watercolor. It's an opaque watercolor, and you have to go light to dark. And she really has to be dialed in. So her execution and her control of the gouache is truly remarkable. But you're right. You probably wouldn't see that if you were just looking at it online. It would almost look like an acrylic, or some might mistake it for oils. Now, she does paint in oil, but you can really see in person the difference between her gouache and her oils.
Yeah. Another thing that we talked about when I stopped by was that you mentioned that you have something like 40 artists in your gallery. And then kind of as an aside, you said that, yeah, but you know, it should probably be only 25 or something like that. My numbers might be slightly off. But what I found really interesting about that is that there is sort of a sweet spot for the number of artists in a gallery. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm going to just break it down to simple mathematics. So we try to do about 4 shows a year. Sometimes we do about 5. We'd like to get our artists to show every 2 to 3 to 4 years just to keep the work on the focal point, to keep it fresh, to remind people that it's there, and also to show how it's progressing. Well, if you, let's just say you're going to throw a group show in there at least once a year. So that's one artist right there. That's one show. You have, if you're going to do 4 shows a year, you now have 6 artists that you can really focus on for the remaining part of the year. Now, maybe you can do a group show that has 3 artists, but then you start kind of diluting everything. So after the end of 2 years, you've probably shown anywhere between 12 to 15 of your artists. Well, then you have to reset that. And you still have, if you've got 40, you still have 25 other artists that you have to pay attention to. So then you do a third year. Now you're maybe around 20. Well, all of a sudden, what about the artists that you did a show for 3 years ago? So it's kind of a complex formula because, it's not even that complex of a formula, actually. It's just simple algebra. With a group show, you lose kind of that overall effect. Sometimes a work can look great on its own, but sometimes it needs the entire show to really give it context and to give it meaning. We'd like to give all of our artists a fair and equal shot. Now, sometimes artists have other commitments or they can't paint enough for a full show, and that helps. But really, you're not doing the artist any services if you're just collecting artists for the sake of putting on your website and having a lengthy roster. That doesn't do anyone any favors, unless, of course, you have 1 or 2 works here and there. But that's not really our model. Our approach is we want to help the artists. We want the artists' work to be seen. We want them to have a vehicle for which they can put out their work. And you can't really do that if you're saying, all right, artists A, B, C, and D, we only want 3 works, 4 works, 5 works for this upcoming show. That's not necessarily fair to them. And it becomes a numbers game.
I'm curious too. I know you've had some artists there for a very, very long time, and you've been able to, you know, that you and the gallery have been able to watch their work kind of evolve over the years. Can you talk about that? Like when you get a, for example, if you have a relatively young artist and they're producing really excellent work, and then they start to experiment and shift and play with new things, how do you communicate with the artist about that? What does that look like from your perspective? Does it scare you when you see artists start to really experiment, or how do you handle that?
It's a great question, because and the simple answer is it depends. But going beneath the surface, it's no pun intended, but it's really an art, because on one hand you want to go with what sells, and you know that sells, and you have reassurance in that. There is no guarantee that an artist's previous work will translate into new and better work. I think Damien Hirst is a great example, using someone on the macro level. You know, you have his spin paintings that maybe weren't as well received as the pharmaceutical works. And you want to encourage the artist, but sometimes you do have to hone them in and rein them in and say, okay, this is too much of a radical change. This is not necessarily what people are expecting. I think we've been pretty lucky. Two artists who come to mind immediately who have changed over the years, but actually three artists, but are still marketable and still resonate with people: Chuck Arnaldi, Robert Brady, and Mark Catano. Chuck is out of Southern California, and Mark and Bob are both out of the Bay Area, Bob out of Berkeley and Mark out of Sonoma. And if you look back at their bodies of work from, say, 20 years ago, because I think we've had each artist for at least 20 years. I know we have for Mark. I know we have for Bob. And I think Chuck's been even longer than that. You can really see a shift. But it also makes sense, because they're not deviating so far away from what they've done that people aren't able to recognize it. So you really have to put a lot of faith in the artist. And they don't necessarily sometimes know how things are going to be received either. Look, Chester Arnold, one of our artists, likes to say that every time he makes a piece, and every time somebody buys a painting of his, it's like he's selling part of his soul. And he means that in a good way, because he has such an attachment to those works. Mm-hmm. He has spent so much time painting them and creating them, thinking about them, that artists can get, what's the saying? You can't see the forest through the trees. They get so focused on that work. So it's up to us to kind of help act as a rudder, so to speak. But we've been very blessed and fortunate that we have artists who are great and creative and understand where they want to go. And maybe if a direction it seems a little too extreme, there's at least a connection that we can help bridge for the client and even just the consumer. Because look, most people who come into our gallery just come and look, and we think that's fabulous. Of course, we would love it if everybody who came and bought something, but that's not the reality. And so there is that, we have a certain responsibility to educate people who come in, not only about the artist, but maybe about the subject matter or the type of work that's on the walls or on the floor if it's a sculpture. It's we don't pretend that we're a museum, but in the same sense, we understand that people just want to expand their horizons. And so if we have an artist who's going a little too far, or maybe who's just going a little too far off the beaten path, we'll have a conversation with them, and we'll ask, hey, where are you going with this? What are you doing here? What was your thinking behind this? And a lot of the times, it'll make sense. Some of the times we have to say, all right, let's bring it back down to earth. But by and large, those conversations are few and far between, because we try to give artists a lot of latitude. Look, we can't. It's not fair for us to stifle their voice. I think you see this with a lot of kids who are coming out of art school right now. They're having gobs of money thrown at them by, let's call them what they are, art speculators, that they don't get a chance to develop. They don't get a chance to find their voice. And that's problematic in 10 or 15 years, because then that artist hasn't grown and they haven't had that mental path of, all right, how do I want to grow? How do I want to change? Where do I want to go with this? And they don't get that feedback by having something that doesn't work. Failure is an important aspect for an artist because it helps put things into perspective, just like it does for all of us in every aspect, but especially with art, because the artist is putting themselves out there. And they can learn more sometimes from that failure than they can from those successes.
This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies. I asked Brian Trakel, founder of Trakel Art Supplies, what it was like when he started to make brushes.
The way brushes were made in the good old days, when I first got into it and went to Kumano, which is a little teeny agricultural town outside of Hiroshima, it was all home workers. The guy would have a little factory, but they didn't all come to work there. They came and got the materials and took them home and made the brushes. And Bechhofen is the town in Germany where I went to meet Frederick Behringer to try and perfect some of the problems I was having when I started making brushes. Just not satisfied with my quality. But he was fourth generation, and everybody in Bechhofen was a brush maker. And they come, get the materials, take them home, make brushes. That's the way it was all made. It was really fascinating because 1875, his great-grandfather started the business. He already had well over 100 years of brush making experience. His house was right across the street from that factory, and we're sitting in his office. He says, well, actually, I was born in this room. This used to be a house, my parents' bedroom, and this is where I was born. Wow.
As his company has evolved, Brian has maintained that same legacy of carefully crafted brushes.
We still do have the legacy. My head brush maker has been with me 30 years.
Trakel offers sensibly priced art supplies conveniently shipped right to your door. Go to Trakel.com and use promo code SAVVY16 to get 15% off your next order.
What I think is really interesting about what you said is how much of the communication comes into it. When an artist is experimenting, basically they kind of have to tell you, the gallery owner or the gallery manager, what they're doing so that you can translate for the people that come into the gallery, for the collectors or people who, you know, like I would call them the future collectors, the people who just come in and look and aren't really sure what they think about art yet and are interested, but they're not ready to buy yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also a key component as well. And that's another reason why we like to nurture the artist's career, because those people who, I mean, you nailed it right on the head when you said that those young buyers or those young enthusiasts who may not be able to afford, well, 20 years from now, they might be able to afford to buy that Bob Brady work or that Galen Hansen work or that Chuck Arnoldi work that they couldn't 20 years ago. So that's why that education component is paramount, because, again, our clients, in theory, are hopefully going to be around. Hopefully we establish a relationship with them that on some level they feel a connection with us or they trust us, or at the very least, they enjoy coming into our gallery. And I'm not certain I kind of answered your question there. I think I deviated a little bit. I went off onto a tangent, which I tend to do every so often. But
I don't think I actually asked you a question. It was more of an observation.
Fair enough. Well, all you got to do is just give me a carrot and I'll keep talking.
It's great. I love it. The topic was kind of the communication and the between the artist and the gallery owner again. So critical, and being able to talk about your work and say, like, look, here's what I'm playing with. This is why I'm playing with it. Maybe this isn't, ready for a gallery yet, but I'm going to take, I'm experimenting with this and here's why. And that gives you the starting point of a conversation, as opposed to, here's my work, and you're shocked by the fact that this has nothing to do with what you've been doing before. So, obviously you're going to be kind of confused about it. So, that conversation, and that, again, as you mentioned earlier, the relationship between the artist and the gallery isn't just when you're having a show.
Exactly. Because we still, even in between shows, we'll put up gallery artists throughout, because people will just come in and they want to see what's on the walls or what's new or what's different. And communication is so, so key. Just because we haven't had a show with an artist in a few years doesn't mean we aren't talking with them. We're constantly in touch with them. In fact, one of my personal favorites, who also incidentally happens to be one of our artists, which this is, as an aside, this is one of the things I really, really love about this industry, and especially with what we do at our gallery, is that we sell what we like. So an artist, and I think I may have shown you his work, a guy named Dan Duque, who's out of San Diego, just outside San Diego. And he does these works that are they're like pop art, but they're almost like trompe l'oeil on steroids. And I'll try to explain them as quickly as possible. They're basically, our last show we had with him had Mac boxes, Apple computer boxes.
Right, I remember him.
100% hand-painted. And people don't believe it at first. It's cognitive dissonance personified in a conversation. They say, no way, that's BS. That's just a computer box. And we have to show them, and we turn it around, and so they can see that it is hand-painted on canvas. Well, we did the show with him in April, but I don't know when the next one with him is going to be. That being said, we're still talking. What do you have? Hey, what's new? What's different? Maybe what can you send us that we can show our clients, people who've shown interest in your work, or that we can just have on display? And what he's doing now is he's doing, and they're fabulous, they're Art Forum magazines. These are all paintings, but it's an Art Forum magazine with his work on it. But again, it's all paintings. So it's almost like that you're looking into the mirror, which is looking back into the mirror, back into the mirror, back into the mirror. It's almost the snake eating the tail theory. They're fabulous. They're incredible. But we wouldn't know that if we didn't keep in touch with him, if we didn't say, hey, what do you have? What are you working on? Or if he didn't send us something saying, hey, look, this is what I'm doing now. What do you think? Because our artists will bounce things off of us, specifically Turkey. Turkey has, and Pete, both of them have remarkable eyes. And I think that's why we're able to get where we are with our artists, because they trust us and they trust the eyes that Pete and Turkey have created and honed over the course of 40 plus years. And hopefully down the road with the current yokels working at the gallery. But that's a whole other conversation. But again, communication is so key, because those relationships mean so much. They're not just our artists, they're our friends. And I would hope that that our artists would say the same. I would think they would, but you never know. I mean, there's always two sides to the coin, but we genuinely love our artists, and we think that they genuinely like us, because a lot of the times we'll talk about art for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and then it's Bob Brady's a great example. We'll talk about his work for 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll spend an hour and a half on the phone talking about random things in the Bay Area. During last summer, it was the Warriors' collapse against the Cavs in the NBA Finals. And we will just chat for hours upon hours, to the point where we'll look at our watches and go, oh my God, I actually have to do some work here. But that's, again, it's the beauty of this industry and what we get to do on a daily basis. We have great relationships with these people, and we genuinely love them.
As a follow-up to that question, you know, to that conversation about the relationship with your artists, there's also, you know, the other side of the coin, or the cube, or whatever you want to call it, is the relationship with the collectors. And this really struck me, probably because when I came to your gallery, I was literally right off of the plane coming back from New York and seeing some galleries there. And frankly, after doing my little gallery hop all over Chelsea in New York, you walk in the door and they don't look up and they don't speak to you. I was expecting that when I walked into your gallery. And so I was actually kind of surprised when you're like, hey, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, like greeting me and genuinely interested in what brought me into the gallery and if there was anything in particular that I wanted to see. So it made it really easy to talk to you and really comfortable to be in the gallery. So I'd love it if you could talk about how you interact with collectors and what your relationship with collectors looks like.
Well, this has always baffled us at the gallery, and this might be somewhat of a heretical statement, but we've never understood why you can't engage with somebody. And this happens even on the West Coast. It's not just an East Coast versus West Coast thing. There are plenty of times where one of us will be down at a gallery in Southern California or in Northern California, and it'll be the exact same treatment. And look, we're all people. We're not coming in there to be ignored. Oftentimes people just want to be left alone to look at the works, and that's totally fine. But it can be intimidating to talk about art, to ask about art. A
yes.
lot of people feel that maybe they need to speak about it academically. And we couldn't think that that's further from the truth, because we think that's further from the truth. I think I screwed that one up. Let me try that one again in English. We think that's wrong. There we go. Because the art is such a personal thing that it's great if you can talk about it academically, but by no means Is it a requirement? And in a sense, I guess it's kind of breaking down that barrier of, hey, if you have a question, it's fine. Ask away. You're not going to be judged. You're not going to be scoffed at. You're not going to be looked at, or we're not going to say, well, I'm sorry, you need to leave now. You are no longer this high to ride the ride. Because there are some works that are confusing. Shoot, we look at art every single day for, golly, hours upon end. And there are, we still have questions all the time. I mean, there's an artist, and I won't mention his name, but he was in a Sotheby's sale. I think it was a Sotheby's sale a few years ago. And the painting was so simple. And I found myself saying, I don't get it. I don't understand why this fetched $5 million. And I'm in the art world. And that's a very real thing. If that's our profession and we're having those questions, it would be foolish of us to think that others don't have that question. And it gets back to the education component. There's nothing wrong with engaging somebody with getting their thoughts on the work and explaining it to them. I mentioned earlier, if everybody who came into our gallery bought something, what a wonderful Christmas we would have.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Just simply not the case. So I we've never understood why that barrier has to be there. We're not putting on some show. There isn't some requirement that you have to be snooty or that you must flash a certain amount of cachet in order to be spoken to. Not at all. I mean, the art world is fun. A lot of times the art world takes itself way too seriously. And that's where it gets sad, because art means so much to so many people. It doesn't need to be such a serious endeavor. And I'm not trying to undermine it by saying it should be goofy and fun and lighthearted, but it doesn't need to be so serious that it becomes exclusive. And I think that's what happens in a lot of cases. We're not trying to change anything. I mean, look, if that whole mentality worldwide changed all of a sudden, I think everybody would be better for it, that being, you know, people engaging and having a conversation about the work. But that's just not going to happen. But that's not our approach. And maybe it is a West Coast thing. Maybe it is because we've been around for almost 50 years that we're comfortable in our own skin. I'm not entirely certain, but I feel the same thing when we go into galleries where the person won't look up at us. Now, I understand if they're on the phone or they're in the middle of something, but where they just simply won't acknowledge us. It's a bad, bad precedent to set for somebody who's coming in. Because look, we've had buyers, we've had clients who are wearing jeans, a shirt untucked, their hair is disheveled, and you wouldn't think twice about them, who've ended up buying several significant works. And then we've had the opposite, where you have the person in the jacket and the tie and the nice shoes, and you think, oh yeah, this person's going to drop a lot of coin, and they don't do anything. So it's not right, nor is it fair of us to judge them based on just their appearances. You never know who you find, who you meet. It's really not that hard of a concept, and yet for whatever reason, it kind of belies common sense. But I don't know why. I wish I knew why, but we certainly hate being treated like that when we go into other galleries, and we wouldn't want to do that to any of our clients and non-clients, just even visitors.
Right. Have you had any people come in who had sort of a surprising reaction to the work, or a particularly memorable conversation that you had with somebody who just kind of wandered into your gallery?
I do. And it was, and I don't mean to name drop it, but it was a professional athlete, a former baseball pitcher, who it was actually with our Dan Duque show about 6 months ago. No, now it's 8 months ago. I don't know. Math is hard. That's why I'm in the art world. And I still wake up with in cold sweats over this one. So one of Dan's works was sculptural. It was 15 pieces of lumber. Again, these are all hand-painted canvases, but it was designed to look like a bundle of lumber. And on the back, it's exposed so you can see the canvas. Well, on the front, you know, you've got the he'll take a mold, and that's how he kind of gets the edges to make it really look like a piece of wood. So you've got the colors on top like you would at a lumber yard. You've got staples in the lumber where a paper was, indicating that perhaps it was a delivery. Uh-huh. And so this athlete comes in, and I knew who he was because in a previous life I was a big sports fan and still am. But I knew exactly who he was. We started talking, and I started mentioning this work of Dan's to him. And I said, you know, take a look at it. Doesn't this look like lumber? And he said, yeah, that's lumber. Why do you have that out here? That's stupid. And I took him around to the back, and I said, look, see, you can see the exposed canvas. You can see that it's just all painted, that it's a canvas reinforced by wood. So it's sculptural, but it's a canvas. He walks back to the front, and he says, dude, I'm telling you, this is lumber. And I said, it's not. You saw. And he goes, it is. And this is a big guy. He's 6'4". He was a right-handed pitcher, so his right hand is really strong. He rears his hand back and pounds on the work. And I hope Dan isn't listening. The work is fine, Dan. But he pounds on the work twice, and it erupts with this loud boom, boom, boom. And he goes, "See, it's wood." And I was so grateful that it was reinforced.
Oh, my God. I would be having a heart attack.
I mean, my face went white. I had never seen anything like that. I had never seen – we don't encourage people to touch the work, but we're not a museum. We're not going to chop off their hands. I mean, one of our artists, Bill Braun, is a trompe l'oeil master, where people have to touch it to see that it is just paint and that it's not dimensional. But I had never seen anybody just slam their hand into it. And I still wake up thinking, oh, my God, what could have been? If he had damaged that work, I would have felt horrible. And that would have just been one of the worst things that had ever happened with somebody randomly coming in. And that's still one of my favorite stories to tell about Dan's work, because, I mean, that speaks to the power of his work. It fools people. It gets people thinking, because it's not what it seems. But when this athlete just hammered on it, I mean, talk about a cure for constipation.
Yeah, I can imagine. Wow. Did he believe you before he left, or was it
I'm
just
not certain.
Like what did he
at that point, it dawned on me that he might not have the comprehension for it. Maybe that it was just he'd spent too much time in locker rooms. But that's one of those stories where I'll never, ever, ever forget that. Another one, and not that it happens with trompe l'oeil, but this seems to be kind of a good indicator, with this Seattle artist named Bill Braun. His works are, you know, small to medium size. I think our biggest piece is 36x48, and we have pieces that are 14x10. What it is it's all paint. It's that of construction paper, like a little kid would do, cutting out a bird and then stapling it onto a piece of paper, much like a 6-year-old would do. Mm-hmm. But it's all painted. And so when we put them on the walls, I call it the head bounce effect, because Bill does a masterful job of capturing shadows and really giving it the appearance that the paper is not fully attached to the canvas, when it all is, because it's all paint. So people will try to see the shadows. They'll try to look under the paper and they'll hit their head off the wall because they forget that the wall is there. They're so busy trying to look to see, all right, where does the paper meet? Where is the staple? Even though it's not stapled, it's all painting. And if you see his work, you'll know what I'm talking about.
I remember seeing that when I stopped by, and it was in the back room and it wasn't on the wall, and you pulled it out. So I know it's trompe l'oeil. I know that, but I still had to touch it. It was so amazing.
Yeah. And that's again, because if we didn't engage people, not to get back to that topic, but if we didn't talk to people, that's not fair to Bill. That's not fair to the artist, because the individual might not understand that that's trompe l'oeil. They might look at that and think, my kid could do that, mm-hmm. and move on and completely dismiss it. That's not giving the artwork a chance. That's not giving the artist a chance. And I think that's just kind of what we've done for 40 plus years. It's not hard. It's just common sense. I mean, you don't walk into a car lot expecting to know everything, not to compare this to car sales, but you don't walk into a car lot expecting to know every single thing about the car. You need to engage with somebody. Same exact principle in the art world. Same exact principle really with anything that might be new and foreign.
Nice. So I have this kind of little Facebook group for people who listen to the Savvy Painter podcast. So I posted on there that I'm talking to you right now to see if anyone has any questions. And Jane Mitchell, who listens to this show, wanted to know, how do you like to be approached by artists inquiring about representation? So in general, what do you think are some of the best ways for artists to approach a gallery?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad that you asked it, because a lot of artists don't know how to do that. For us personally, now, first off, because we have so many artists, we are unable to take on any new artists. But whenever somebody sends us something after I get through explaining our process, we do keep it, because you never know down the road. And also, we were involved in a number of other projects that aren't necessarily related to the gallery's specific operations, but that are very much in lockstep with the gallery. A real quick example that Turkey Stremmel spearheaded, one of our big hospitals here, Renown Health, has a healing garden, and they have, I think, something like 2,000 pieces of artwork. Well, we don't have 2,000 artists, and our artists don't have to, most of them don't have 2,000 pieces of art. Turkey spearheaded this project where it was almost like a call to artists, trying to get as many different artists into Renown as possible. Now that project has completed, but that's one of the reasons why we hang on to things that we think might resonate with individuals. So to your question, I'll tell you first what absolutely drives us nuts. If you're an artist, and now with email, it's a lot easier. Before, it would be people who would just drop in randomly, which again, would be somewhat bothersome because that's not necessarily respecting our time because we might have stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So what we like is we like it if somebody calls in advance and says, hey, blah, 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 this is what I have, this is who I am. And we have to tell them, look, we can't take you on right now, maybe down the road, but send me something anyway so I can take a look at it. Or maybe I know somebody who could help find a spot for you, or maybe another gallery who would be interested in your work, which has happened. What we hate, what we absolutely do not like, is when somebody randomly comes in and brings their entire body of work, because that just completely monopolizes what we were just doing. It undercuts everything we were just doing and monopolizes our time going forward. With email, and there will be no faster way for me to delete it than if somebody does this. When an artist sends an email, they've taken the time to find our email address, but they haven't taken the time to find, because our email address is right there with all of our names, mm-hmm. and they send to director or to whom it may concern or hi there, and they say, this is my body of work, please click on the link. That's making me do the work. And I'm in my head, I think, wait, right now you as the artist need the gallery more than the gallery needs you. It's incumbent on you as the artist to say, hi, Parker. My name is so-and-so. This is how I found your gallery. And people will try to make connections with it. My favorite is when they say, I've noticed that you have this artist, and my work I think would show great, and it's completely opposite of what that artist represents. But at least they've taken the time to look at it. And then they send me some images with that email, so I don't have to click on a hyperlink and go through all of the technicalities of a website and hope that the internet connection works, or that it's a matter of seconds, yes, but it's annoying. It's annoying. Look at it this way. If you were 19 years old and you're straight out of high school, or you're 22 years old and you're straight out of college, if you're 19 years old and straight out of high school, something went wrong at some point. You're 18 years old and straight out of college, or you're 22 years old, straight out of 18 out of high school, 22 out of college, and you're trying to get a job, you don't say, hey, come see me. You put on your best foot. You put on your best presentation. You put your best foot forward. It's like that 45-second elevator pitch. Yeah. And it's the same deal. An artist trying to get into a gallery is a job interview. And I don't think a lot of artists look at it that way. I think some of them come from the perspective of, well, I was best in my class, so I've always been received well. And they don't think of it from the standpoint of, hey, I need to get these guys' attention. I need them to see my work. Instead, some will go in there with the approach of, look at how great my work is, come and find it. It just ain't going to work that way, because we're one gallery, but there are thousands of artists out there, and a lot of them will send us emails, usually blanket emails saying hi there or to whom it may concern, which automatically means delete because they haven't done the research. But look at it from the same perspective you would a job interview for any other industry, whether it's you want to get into, I don't know, what are other jobs? You want to work at a law firm, or you want to work at a museum. How would you approach it that way? Same right. Exact.
Yeah, that is, I mean, oh my gosh, I could do an entire show on this, because I hear you. And on I'm sure on a much smaller scale, I get similar emails of people who want to be on the show. And I'm just like, A, you spelled my name wrong. So
yeah. Yeah. Our generic email address is info@stremmelgallery.com. You have to type out Stremmel for the domain. And then when they spell Stremmel wrong in the email body, it's almost more amusing than anything, because they had to go to more effort to misspell it because they spelled it right already.
Yeah.
You know, one other thing I want to add too is, now we do a lot more rejecting than we do accepting, but that doesn't mean the work is bad. A lot of the time it just means it's not a fit for our client base. It's not a fit for what our program is. We've had a lot of work that's really, really good and really strong, but we just can't sell it. I mean, there are a number of artists whose work I'm infatuated with, but I don't think I could sell it to our client base just because it's not there. It's not up their alley. It's like with Phyllis Schaefer's work, who paints the Sierra Nevada mountain ranges. I don't know if somebody in Atlanta, Georgia is going to resonate with that unless they have some referent to the Sierra Nevada mountain ranges. Someone in South Florida maybe isn't, well, not Miami, but maybe somebody on the panhandle side of Florida, maybe Jacksonville, Florida, is not going to relate with our landscape painters, just as our client base probably isn't going to relate with southern landscapes. And that's kind of goes without saying. So it doesn't mean that the work is bad or that it's not good. A lot of the times it means it's just not a fit for our specific clients.
Right. That's such a great point too. I think so much of it comes down to, you know, number one, do your homework. It's not, especially with the internet, it's not that hard.
Yes, it really isn't. I mean, you can type up, you can just type in anybody's name on Google and find about five embarrassing things on that individual. It's not that difficult. If you've taken the time to find the website, you can take five more seconds to figure out who is whom.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, that's so, it's such a, and also, I mean, I think no matter who you are as an artist, if you're approaching somebody else to ask them to do something, it's, you're kind of in the, I don't want it to sound bad, but you're kind of in the subordinate position, right? So mm-hmm. you need yeah. to take the time, like your job in that case is to make it easy on that other person, because you don't know what they're doing when they get the email. You don't know
exactly
what's going on in the gallery at that moment. And, you know, like there can be a billion things going on. And if you want to make a good impression, make it easy. Make it so, so simple.
Yeah, exactly. Do the work, because you've already done the hard work in creating the painting or the sculpture or whatever it may be. Go the extra step. Do that extra 10%, because I assure you, we're all humans. It's the Malcolm Gladwell blink effect. If yeah. we see something and we have a bad taste in our mouth right away on it, it all of a sudden puts that individual at a disadvantage. Do that extra 10%, because I assure you it'll serve you in the long run. It really does. Because again, we're not coming from your perspective as the artist. We're coming from our own individual perspective. And I think that gets lost a lot of the time. It's a human interaction. And it's so funny how that's kind of almost a foreign concept in the art world. It gets back to just greeting people. It gets back to communicating with your artist. They're human to human interactions, and paintings, sculptures are part of you, the artist's soul. You want that to be represented as well as possible. And you don't do yourself any favors if you're taking a shortcut by saying hi there, or if they spell your name wrong, Antrice, or if they add an E to the end of your last name and don't spell wood correctly. You're just putting yourself at a disadvantage, and it's avoidable.
Yeah, it's like going into a job interview with a wrinkled shirt and you know,
bingo,
mismatched perfect socks, and you know you haven't combed your hair yet.
Yeah, perfect. Well, we like mismatched socks at our gallery. Nobody has plain socks at our gallery, but your point is 100% accurate. It is a job interview, but nobody looks at it as a job interview. But that's yeah. what it is.
This has been an amazing conversation, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to talk to me.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope I haven't bored the listeners too much, because as I'm thinking back on what was said and how it was said, it does feel as if maybe I was afflicted by verbal diarrhea. So I hope that there wasn't too much rambling, and I hope people at least were able to follow along a little bit. If not, I apologize, but I can't refund that time.
Well, the other thing I think people will definitely appreciate is, Parker, you have a son that's now a week and a half?
2 weeks, actually, 2 weeks today. So he's still unemployed. So if there are any artists out there who need an artist assistant, he is dexterous and he's got nimble fingers. So I think he can be good for cleaning brushes or anything else around the studio. So I'll have him put a resume together, and I'll make sure when he does it, that he does it the right way, that he doesn't just say, hi, artist.
I love it. Parker, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. This is fantastic.
And Therese, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's fabulous, and I love listening to it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Parker Stremmel.
Thank you again to Parker for going the extra mile by allowing me to interview him just 2 weeks after the birth of his son. And thank you also to his wife for giving up the extra hand on a Saturday, no less. If you are in the Reno area, stop by the gallery. You still have about a week to check out Phyllis Schaefer's exhibit, and there's always something good there if you're listening to this after December 10th. That's 2016. Go to SavvyPainter.com for show notes and for links to all of the artists that we talked about in this episode. Also, I have some news for you. I am finally getting ready to launch a very special membership program. This has been percolating for quite a while now, and like most things worth doing, it's taking a bit longer than I'd hoped for, but I'm super, super excited to bring it into fruition. It's going to be an ongoing program for artists. We will be covering painting and creativity, getting your work out there and promoting yourself, and finding your collectors. All of that within a very supportive community. If you want more information, you can put yourself on the early bird list at savvypainter.com/earlybird. As I get closer to the launch date, it's coming soon, I promise. You will be the first to know, and you will be eligible for the lowest possible price. So, if you want to be part of this exclusive group, again, it's savvypainter.com/earlybird. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.